Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
We really do.
Here's John Williams.
Doesn't always work out, but I want you to know we're trying our best. Hi, it's John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here until 3 o'clock today. On Saturdays, we go 10 a.m. until 12 noon. Don't forget, this Friday, we're going to be at Cork and Kerry again, wrapping up another White Sox season. The first on WGN Radio in years and years and years. And looky who they're playing, the Chicago Cubs on Friday. So are you going to go to the game? Go to the game. Come by our broadcast either way. We'll be at Cork and Kerry starting in the morning and going through my show and then the pregame coverage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We'll talk about sports a little later on in the broadcast of this show. Good grief, that was an interesting weekend. And I have the habit of turning off games at the worst possible moment. I thought Ohio State was going to lose. I turned it off. I thought Northwestern was going to win. I turned it off. I thought there's no way the Vikings make a comeback in this game. It'll end in regulation. I turned it off. How about those Green Bay Packers? Those fans must be, I don't know if they're in a real good mood today. I mean, a tie in the NFL is the most anticlimactic thing. I don't know why they don't just keep playing.
Based on field goals.
What's your point about field goals?
Well, they kept missing them.
I know. I feel so bad. As a former field goal kicker for Manuka Community High School and Joliet Junior College my freshman year, I think I know what that guy's going through. There is no worse feeling in the world. Okay, maybe a scratched cornea, but I mean, oh my gosh, childbirth, whatever. You get my point, that you are such a solitary figure. And you're not as big as the other guys. You know, it sort of feels like you're not really a football man, but for some reason, football decided that one of the most important things in their game will be somebody who doesn't even look like he's in the game. He comes out and he misses a 49-yarder. He misses a 41-yarder. But then they get pretty close, and it's like, heck, I kicked a field goal that far my sophomore year in high school. I really did. Now, granted, the Minnesota Vikings weren't bearing down on me, nor were the Green Bay Packers. But I teed that sucker up. Eddie Norton put it down, and we put it right through the uprights. Eddie looked at me and thought, I mean, this is almost what he said. He went, whoa. I said, Ed, we've practiced that. He goes, yeah, but as we're trotting off the field, neither of us could believe that we had successfully executed a field goal there in Manuka High School. So anyway, the field goal kicker for the Vikings goes out now, and all he's got to do is hit one. Just hit one. He's new to the game. So far in his early career, he's, I think, 1 for 3. Not good. He goes out to hit the next one, win the game, and it goes wide. And he looks at it, and he can't believe it.
Can I get it one more time?
I know. It's like, oh, give me one more shot at that. I know it. If John Williams and Ed Norton can do this, I know I can do this. Ed, if you're listening, shout out to you, man. I remember that more than maybe you do. Yeah, so that was a tough scene. It was just a weird weekend of baseball. We're making the Reds look good. So anyway, White Sox and Cubs will come your way on WGN Radio. How about that? That'll be a lot of fun on Friday. Also going on this weekend, the Kavanaugh hearings. Well, now today. Now, we're going to check later in the show with the Jason Van Dyke trial and see how the first day of testimony went. But this Kavanaugh thing is sort of snowballing, isn't it? There were charges against Justice Kavanaugh. Should they slow down his confirmation hearings because a woman says back in high school that he tried to sexually assault her? But the letter was written and handed to members of Congress. They had it in their hands in July. So why did it take this letter so long to get from somebody on the committee to in Congress to the committee or to all of our attention? You know, maybe you and I don't need to know about this, but somebody does. And at the last minute, they dropped this letter on there. I still don't have an explanation for why it took so long for this letter to surface. But here we are again now, as we get ready to nominate a Supreme Court justice, wondering how to gauge the veracity of and what to do with sexual abuse charges against a Supreme Court justice nominee. Is anybody else replaying Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas in their heads? There she was saying this absolutely happened. There he was saying it absolutely did not happen. I know the circumstances and the stories aren't perfect, but there are some parallels here, aren't there? And each one seemed to be pretty credible. Two members of the committee or Congress, what am I reading here? It says two Democrats are calling for Kavanaugh and the accuser to testify. So we do know this lady's name. There's her picture on the front page of websites. So you do know a little bit more about her now. She says this is what happened. And the question gets nuanced this way, too, doesn't it? Suppose she is telling the truth. Should something that happened that long ago matter today? I mean, it's a terrible thing. It was attempted sexual assault. The kid evidently, her version of the story is that they were at a party. He was drunk. He and another classmate got on top of her. He put his hand over her mouth, tried to assault her. She was able to fend him off and escaped. That's her version of the story. He's saying that didn't happen. What do we do with that? What do we do with that? At least hit the brakes. Our news click is going to give you some options. We're asking you what your opinion on this story is. What should we at least do about it for now? And does it matter that when Kavanaugh was advising Ken Starr in the Bill Clinton impeachment trial, he said, absolutely, we should be specific and graphic. We should. Now, he has since moderated his views on this line of attack. But Kavanaugh's advice to Ken Starr about Bill Clinton, remember, Kavanaugh's advice to Ken Starr, he was helping on that impeachment trial. His advice to the special prosecutor, Ken Starr, was to be specific and aggressive and graphic. Tell the story, because Bill Clinton had so sullied the office of the presidency, he said he was outraged by it and something needs to be done. Here's an exact quote from his memo to Ken Starr in August of 98. He said, I am strongly opposed to giving the president any break in questioning regarding the details of the Lewinsky relationship before his questioning on Monday unless he either resigns or confesses perjury and apologizes. The idea of going easy on him at the questioning is abhorrent to me, said Kavanaugh, about Clinton's relationship with Lewinsky. Well, don't you hate digital records, Mr. Kavanaugh? Because you can read his memo to Ken Starr, and were it applied to him, we would definitely hit the brakes, and we would give this a full herring. Did I say herring? We don't want to give it a full herring. What would you do with a herring? Give it a full hearing.
For a second, I thought you were referring to a red herring, and I thought, this isn't a red herring.
When you go back and listen to, and, you know, maybe this doesn't have anything to do with Brett Kavanaugh, but when you go back and listen to the Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas hearings, which were just so bizarre, because they went late into the night and the next day, and you thought this thing was a done deal, and Clarence Thomas looked and sounded like a credible nominee. Everything was good about him. And then this thing surfaces. And so what do you do with that? The problem, at least in part, was that Anita Hill look, the part two, she was credible and sincere and intelligent. And you can't imagine that she had a motive. You can't imagine that she was playing politics. She avoided the spotlight as much as she could. Asking her to testify at length, Joe Biden, a younger Joe Biden. And all of these senators were, I think, thorough, but also just wanted to get out of that room. I mean, here's a bunch of white men, late ages and middle ages, asking this woman about sex and about pornography and about the charges against somebody else who they were about to pass judgment on. Here's a couple of clips. Let's start with Clarence Thomas 1. This is him after the hearings had gotten underway. And, you know, he'd made a good presentation, and then she surfaces. So now he's trying to defend himself.
Unequivocally, uncategorically, I deny each and every single allegation against me today that suggested in any way that I had conversations of a sexual nature or about pornographic material with Anita Hill, that I ever attempted to date her, that I ever had any personal sexual interest in her, or that I in any way ever harassed her. A second, and I think more important point, I think that this today is a travesty. I think that it is disgusting. I think that this hearing should never occur in America. This is a case in which this sleaze, this dirt, was searched for by staffers of members of this committee, was then leaked to the media.
Just as he's saying some of those things, I had some of the same feelings, like, oh, God, this is ugly, and maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. But you can see the political motives behind the people that got this letter and forwarded this case. So is this really just us on our worst possible display, or is this prudent? And then, as I said, Anita Hill, it's funny because as believable as Clarence Thomas seemed, so too did Anita Hill.
I declined the invitation to go out socially with him and explained to him that I thought it would jeopardize at the time, I considered to be a very good working relationship. I had a normal social life with other men outside of the office. I believed then, as now, that having a social relationship with a person who was supervising my work would be ill-advised. I was very uncomfortable with the idea and told him so. I thought that by saying no and explaining my reasons, my employer would abandon his social suggestions. However, to my regret, in the following few weeks, he continued to ask me out on several occasions. He pressed me to justify my reasons for saying no to him. These incidents took place in his office or mine. They were in the form of private conversations, which would not have been overheard by anyone else.
Clarence Thomas says this. Go ahead and give me Clarence Thomas number two.
I think something is dreadfully wrong with this country when any person in this free country would be subjected to this. This is not a closed room. There was an FBI investigation. This is not an opportunity to talk about difficult matters privately or in a closed environment. This is a circus. It's a national disgrace. And from my standpoint, as a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you.
It's Clarence Thomas, and then after that, he never said another word. As eloquent and angry as he was, he has virtually not spoken from the bench. He has, but I remember it made big news when he finally did, years and years and years later. Your texts include these from 815. John, there are no charges. These are just accusations. True. John, if it's true, then no go to the Supreme Court, says 312. From 708, there was nothing credible about Clarence Thomas's testimony. I think to this day, Americans are in one of two camps, right? Who do you believe? And if you believe Anita Hill, then good grief, imagine the guy that's sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court. John, the Supreme Court should have an 8-year limit. And John, consider this. Under today's laws, a drunk teenager convicted of what Kavanaugh is being accused of would be put on the sex offender list. That would stick with him for the rest of his life. And we'll continue to follow that story today. Baez, Goldschmidt, MVP candidates collide on WGN-TV. Cubs D-backs tonight at 8:30 on WGN Television. Steve, did you watch the Cubs game when Contreras hits the...
I was in and out of that game. I didn't see that.
I did.
No.
I did. So
that was yesterday, right?
This is a pennant race, yeah. And, you know, the Reds were making them look really good. We just are not scoring runs these days. And then there's Wilson Contreras, who's been not hitting well since the All-Star break, and they got all these stats, and he's really underperforming. And then he, boom, barrels up on a ball, and it just goes pow, to center field. And he he does that long, then exaggerated follow-through, drops the bat, and then just very leisurely, I mean, you had to beg him to walk out of the batter's box, just starts to walk. He texted some friends. He called his mom, said, watch where this thing lands. It may be in Spain. And then it bounces off the wall.
He still got a double out of it.
Yeah, he did.
But here's my, wasn't it worse for Addison Russell? Everyone's talking about Wilson Contreras.
Right,
but...
actually, and as much as people are beating him up about it, I don't think there's any scenario where the outcome of that hit changes. It was going to be a double because Russell was on first. He went to second, but if he had just, you know, sprinted all the way to third, they would have doubled him up if that ball had been caught, right? I mean, it wasn't, I don't think Russell made a mistake on the base path.
The way I read it is he was kind of watching from second base.
He was.
He should have scored. He ended on third. I mean, I'm a big Addison Russell fan, but then he had two throwing errors yesterday, so he had a rough day.
Well, okay, then I'll take this back. If Addison Russell was on second, because if he was just standing there enjoying it.
I mean, I think he started on first, but then he sort of rested on second. And
yeah, but I mean, you didn't want him to go all the way to third, Steve, because if the center fielder had caught that ball, they could have doubled him up at first, right?
Well, if you'd seen the way Wilson reacted, we all knew it was a home run. He's really going to get doubled up.
And here's the thing. So my read on it was eventually Russell scores on a sac fly, and Contreras is stranded. But we got one run out of it because he was able to push him along. His look on his face for the rest of the game and for the rest of that inning particularly, they kept cutting to Contreras. He was just like, oh, God. Oh, man. Guys, I'm sorry. Oh, I hate this. Oh, I hate this. I thought it was going out. Oh, I wish I could have run it. Because, you know, he's in that like, aren't I great, walk to first base. And then he goes, oh, well, maybe I'll just walk a little more briskly. And now I'm in a trot. I'm like, oh, no, I'm running as fast as I can. This is so embarrassing. Then he slides into second base, pops up, and he's like, okay, well, we're good. We're good, right? And I thought he was good, just embarrassed, but they're reading more into it. I think we got all of the runs out of those two plays that we were going to get. But maybe Kevin has a different take on that. Steve's got a take on the news. That's right around the corner. Then Bill Daly strolls into our studio here on WGN Radio. He is currently waiting for us in the PPG Paints Green Room. Bill Daly, running for mayor of Chicago. Steve, I invite you to keep your mic on and continue the conversation with us as Bill Daly joins us in our studio. You may have heard Mr. Daly is running for mayor. Welcome to the studio. How are you? Thank you.
I'm good.
I was looking at your Wikipedia the other day. That's what I always do before I interview somebody really important like yourself.
Okay.
And you have such a great Chicago resume. I mean, if you were going to invent a mayor from Chicago, you would, you know, have him go to St. Ignatius in Loyola and then the John Marshall Law School. All three of those boxes are checked in your case. And then you just had an interesting career since then. You were associated with Amalgamated Bank of Chicago, Mayor Brown and Platt. You were the Secretary of Commerce under Clinton. You worked, obviously, with Barack Obama. You were also, it says here, you were on the board of Fannie Mae. I always wanted to be on the board of Fannie Mae because I love the turtles and the vanilla creams.
No, it was the other Fannie Mae. It wasn't the candy company.
Oh,
sorry.
Well, then forget that.
Right.
That's my little joke. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, which of those things really is most relevant to you being mayor? Like, that's how I profile. That's impressive. Right. But... you know, were you the chief executive of, you know, something, or how does that translate to making you a good mayor?
Well, I hope it's a combination of all of those things that you mentioned. You know, I've spent my career mostly in private sector, not government. I've never held political office, but I've been around it, obviously. And I think what I've tried to do both in the private sector and when I've spent time in government is help build consensus around problems to solve them. When I was Commerce Secretary, we had 45,000 employees, a $5.5, $6 billion budget, massive national, international presence. When I was with J.P. Morgan as vice chairman, I think they were the second largest private sector employer in the state of Illinois, in Chicago. So I think they add something that others don't have so far that are in the race, private sector experience at a very senior level, and also the government piece. But the most important, in my opinion, is I've spent my entire life in this city as far as being a resident. My kids, my grandkids, my wife and I love the city. We've enjoyed it. And it's part of us. And I want to be part of trying to help over the next 4 years to address some of these issues.
Mr. Daley, you toyed with or got close to running for governor. I don't remember the exact disposition of it, if you withdrew. Mm-hmm. So how do you tell Chicagoans that you're in this and you're going to stay in it and you're not just testing the waters, you're committed to this race?
I'm not testing the waters. I'm committed. I'm in, and I'm in to the end. It'll be up to the voters to decide if I come in first or last or wherever. But I want to be part of the dialogue and the discussion over the future of the city because, as I said, I feel very special about the city. And so I'm part of it, and I'm into the end, and it's home, very different than the governor's.
I would imagine, though, somebody running for mayor thinks, yeah, but I can fix that. I mean, I'm not running for mayor, but I was born in Chicago and love this city, mm-hmm. too. So what is it that you want to do? What is the problem you think you're going to fix, or how are you going to make Chicago better?
The three big things are safety. That is the crime issue. That is trying to bring some greater sense of security by the people of Chicago about this issue. It is real, it is serious, and it is affecting us not only day in, day out, but globally it's affecting the reputation of the city. And I think we've got to be honest about the discussion. We need a more professional police department, but we also must support the men and women of the police department who I think right now feel pretty much under siege. Based upon the last couple of years.
You think Rahm Emanuel's administration did not support the police enough?
I think it's the people overall. It's not just the government. It's overall the people. I think I've talked to police officers, men and women, and they feel that the public is not supporting them that they should. They go out every day, as you know, to protect us. They're not there to do anything but try to protect us from some awfully bad characters out there.
You're not picking sides on this one, are you? Because I think there's the other argument that says the police have been inordinately aggressive with or unfair to people of color on the South and West Side.
Yeah. I think that there's plenty of evidence that the trust between the community and especially the communities of color and the police department has been broken.
How do you address that?
Well, I think you've got to get the police department, you've got to get the community sitting down saying, what are we really going to do about this? What do you want? I hear from people that even in the brief couple of days that my name's been speculated and running, have come up to me and said, you've got to do something to first support the police department. And I think the expectation that somehow certain communities where there's heavy crime, that they don't want a heavy police presence and a involvement in those communities is not accurate.
What do you make of those rallies then? Are those, we've closed the Dan Ryan, part of Lakeshore Drive, and obviously tried to shut down the Cubs game, and then there was an effort to close down the Kennedy at O'Hare on Labor Day weekend. What do you make of that strategy?
I think the question is, do they move the ball at all to try to get a dialogue going to address the real bottom line issue of crime?
How do you answer that?
I think they highlight the issue, but I don't think a march down the Dan Ryan or the Kennedy is needed to highlight the crime when you look at the shootings every day in the city or the killings in the city. Yeah. So I think it's an important part of making people aware. The idea, will people who are not living in those communities be made aware of the problem in those communities by having a march? I think they're helpful to a certain degree, but they're not going to solve this crime problem. And we can march all day, every day, up and down the streets of Chicago.
Jason Van Dyke trial started today, and yep. I know that you've been asked earlier today and aren't commenting on that, which is certainly understandable. But when a verdict comes either way, it's going to require finessed leadership on the part of Mayor Emanuel. And I'm just wondering how you would handle that. Either way, how it is that you think the people of Chicago should entrust you with that sort of that duty or that leadership? How would you handle this verdict when it comes?
Well, look, again, nobody knows what the verdict's going to be. Obviously, some people predict violence. Violence moves the ball nowhere. It does nothing but hurt our communities. But I think there's a lot of repair to do after this trial is over between the police department, the communities of this city, communities of color, and a mayor. And this mayor will have to stand there before the people of Chicago and have a way that people can express their opinion, positive or negative, to whatever happens. And at the same time, try to bring people together and say, okay, now where do we go? So that we don't have in the police department another one of these incidents. And on the other hand, that we can begin to get the police to be helpful and try and help, more helpful in trying to solve this crime problem, which is real.
Well, I'll answer that question, Steve. Good. I think I would have, you got to have a kumbaya. I think you need church leaders. You need Laquan McDonald's family, who have pressed people to not be violent and to hear the process out. You need the chief of police all in some sort of communal statement, physically in the same space together. Because if Van Dyke is found not guilty, there will be fires. Cars will be upturned.
Let me just say, I think to predict that in your role at this stage is bad for this city. Things may happen, but for people in leadership like yourself, to be predicting, or some people may take that as encouragement, is the wrong way to approach this situation, especially in the week of a trial.
I don't like the sound of it either. I hear what you're saying, but it's not encouragement. It's just saying, if the conversation is, what are we going to do after this verdict is, I would just advise anybody listening to get in front of it, to be prepared for the worst and hope for the best. Right. But I don't think I'm out on a crazy limb there, wondering if that's not going to happen. Let's hope it does not. Let's hope that responsible people are in a position to stem it. You said safety.
It's not just you're right. The responsible people in leadership, in faith leadership, in corporate leadership, in government leadership have got to be ready to step up in community leadership and step forward and say, whatever the verdict is, we've got to pull together for the future of the city.
You said there were three things, and I think we got to safety. What else?
There's safety, strength. Strength being the economic strength of the city. We have brought there is short-term economic stability to our finances, but the long-term finances of this city and the state are in a very difficult state. And the third piece is the affordability. Taxes, housing, the cost of living in Chicago has gotten pretty high for a lot of people. And how do we make it more affordable
speaking
for people
of that,
to live here?
Pardon me. Speaking of that, somebody texted when they heard that you were coming in and said, John, ask Mr. Daley if he supports 1% real estate tax cap. You have anything to say about that?
No, not at this stage.
Is that something, though? I mean, really,
we cannot continue to put the cost of government totally on the back of the homeowners. I mean, people are selling their homes. The assessments in the taxes that have gone up, understandably, in some ways, you're going to have a reassessment that's going on this year, and the taxes next year are going to be rather dramatically higher.
Yeah, well, I think in a lot of neighborhoods that have been enjoying maybe unfair and to their advantage assessments over the years.
Right.
What do you make of what happened in the assessor's office?
Well, I think it was about time that we had a serious change. I think Fritz Craigie is going to do it in a way that's honorable. And I think it was about time that Berrios left office, and it was good that the voters changed the leadership there.
Go ahead, Steve Bertrand.
I was going to change the subject a little bit, but the day after the mayor announced he wasn't running for re-election, he was in that studio, and he said that the winner, his successor, wasn't in the race yet. And now here you are 10 days later in the race. I'm wondering if you had any discussions with him before he made his decision,
no.
Or if you have since. Have you had any since?
I talked to him briefly. I wished he and Amy well. I've known Ram for a long time. It was strictly a personal sort of call of wishing him well. But I think the day after he announced, nobody was in the race.
There were nine people in the race.
But since then, there's probably been 20, 25 people selected.
There's nothing compared to what we have now.
The odds are that the candidate was not there on the day after his election.
Tribune is reporting, I know it's been in and out, but Tribune reporting again today that Toni Preckwinkle will announce this week.
Mm-hmm.
Have you talked to her about the race, or what do you make of her candidacy?
Yeah, I saw President Preckwinkle about 10 days ago, told her I was running. She's been 30 years in government, held elective office. She's got a record she'll run on, and so we'll meet on the campaign trail.
You alluding to the soda tax as part of her record there?
Well, that is part of her record, no doubt about it. For good or bad. Yeah,
we've been trying to weigh that. Like, is that an Achilles heel for her in this campaign, do you think, in this election?
I don't know if it's Achilles heel, but it is part of her record as president. She defended it. She put it in. She defended it. And seemed to want to defend it and keep it in. But that's, you know, she's got a long track record of votes over many years and actions. And so she'll have to defend those. And that's just the way the campaigns go.
Bill Daley's in our studio. He is running for mayor of Chicago. Although, is it official? Like, do you have all the signatures?
Yeah.
And if you
got No. I don't have the petitions done. The filing's been made to create a committee. We're now out getting beginning the petition process.
How many names do you need on those petitions?
12,500.
Where are you going to get 12,500 signatures, sir?
Every part of the city. And you better get twice as many because someone's going to challenge them.
Is that what happens?
Yeah.
I asked him when he came into the studio, I said, do you have the petition with you? He said, no. I said, you should have brought one. I would be carrying that with me wherever I went. Are there too many? No. Does your last name help or hurt you?
It probably in some parts of the city helps me, and in parts of the city it hurts me. But yeah, I'm not going to change my name. So at this stage of my life, I'm proud of it. I'm proud of what my father and brother and other family members have done. But I think the people of Chicago will, I hope they will say, let's check Bill Daley out and not make a decision just because of his last name.
Go ahead, Steve.
I'm sorry, John, but I want to ask two questions. We're talking a lot about running the city from the inside out, you know, violence and all of that. But I'm interested, too, in from outside the city in. Emmanuel has been very effective in bringing investment from outside into the city. There's the Amazon second headquarters and things like that. How important do you think for the next mayor is it to be able to reach out and have establishments outside the city to bring the growth that way rather than focus from inside out?
I think it's vital. We are a global city. That's changed over this is a century that the world has closed in and got much closer. And the next mayor better be able to reach out around the country and around the world to encourage people to come here and invest. And open businesses and grow their businesses. Mayor Emanuel has done a good job of that. My brother Rich did it with bringing Boeing and a number of other companies here to Chicago. That's a big part. It's not all. But we hope to bring those businesses here in order to not only help them and help the downtown section, but help other parts of the city and encourage them to then get involved in other parts of the city, both with charity and with investment if possible. So I think it's an important part of the job of the mayor.
Bill Daley's in the studio. We need to take a quick break. We'll be done with this conversation in about 8 minutes. That means if you want to call or text 312-981-7200, this is a good time. This is WGN. Bill Daley's in our studio. He's running for mayor of Chicago. I asked you about campaign financing. We were talking off the air about how now you got to get people. I mean, hokey smokes. The election isn't tomorrow, but it's fast approaching. Are you going to self-finance your campaign, or how does that go?
Well, I'll put some money in. My wife and I decided if we ought to have skin in the game, as we're asking people to support us. We hopefully will raise a substantial amount of money. I think we will have what we need to win.
How much do you think a candidate needs to win this race?
You know, it's probably anywhere from $5 to $15 million.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you talked? Rom's got 10 just sitting there. And he can't use it now. What's he going to do with his 10 million?
I don't know. I don't know what he'll do with it. He can give it away. He can sit on it. He can give it back. He can do whatever he wants.
If he endorsed you, he could give it to your campaign.
Yeah,
right?
But I believe that the mayor will, like other mayors, probably not get involved in this race and will sit tight, which that's what I would.
What did you do with the money you raised when you ran for governor?
I gave it back.
Did you really? There's you have all the addresses and stuff? And
yeah, I had all the addresses. Now, I could only give 85 cents at a dollar because I didn't want to break the caps at the time. There were caps, Rauner blew by that, and so I was kind of stupid to just give 85 cents on a dollar back. But I thought it was the right thing to do, to be honest with you. I could have kept it in the campaign account, but it was right.
What about other?
Well, you could use it now if you had it.
Yeah, right.
I know you should.
See, that proves that I was not thinking about this over the last 4 years.
Right, you were at least sincere in your run for governor, and now you say you're sincere in this run. The Sun-Times had a little blurb about whether or not you would employ other dailies or family members. Talk briefly about that.
No, it really was. I'm going to have a policy that family members cannot do business with the city of Chicago on behalf of clients or other things. And I'm going to put that policy out over the next couple of weeks.
I think there should be a firewall between the city council and work that aldermen do relative to tax evaluations or things like that as well.
I do, too. I don't think there ought to be the ability for an alderman or elected official to practice that in areas that conflict with their jobs with the public. And there's a serious question whether the alderman ought to be full-time alderman and not have outside income at all. And I think that's worth a serious discussion.
Yeah. Any last thing you want to pass along? We're going to go to the news next. But, Bill, anything else you want to say?
Yeah, I would just say, look, we have a lot of issues. The downtown, as we look out this window, is booming. And we've got to try to find a way over the next couple of years to bring more of that economic success to neighborhoods that are really struggling. Because we are one Chicago. We're together. And we want to bring Chicago together even more than it is today. We have a lot of differences. But we can't let those differences divide us over the next couple of years.
Yeah. Thanks for coming to the studio. It's nice to meet you in person. We'll continue to follow the campaign.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Lodestar.
John Williams.
We have a sighting. It's 2:08. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago. Hi, I'm John Williams, here till 3.
Lord,
Saturdays, 10 a.m. until 12 noon. I think we got a whole Saturday show coming your way this weekend. We've been preempted by football and whatnot lately, but we're anxious to be back in the Saturday studio, too. On social media, I'm WGN King John, WGN King John. And remember, at WGNRadio.com, we post a daily web poll question. We call it the News Click. It asks you about something in the news. Let's see, here's the one we had over the weekend. I don't remember the results on this. Producer Olive, can you tell us what was the weekend News Click, please?
Bill Daly, former Obama Chief of Staff, former U.S. Secretary of Commerce, son and brother to two former Chicago mayors, is running for Chicago mayor. A. Great, I might vote for him, 39%. B. I'll need to think this over, 22%. C. Not great, we've had enough dailies, 48%.
48%. Well, he should pull out then. There's no reason to run now. Here's the question I regret not asking him. Thank you for your calls and texts. John, will we get rid of the red light cameras? Somebody said, but the one I wished I'd asked is, do you think Rich Daly, your brother, made a mistake selling the parking meters? Because I do.
Or the Skyway?
I know. I'm just telling you, look at all of these revenue streams. We spent that money so fast. And now every parking ticket, every nickel that goes in the meter, more, you know, I know we don't put nickels in the meters. We're not getting that. We're just giving it away. We're giving it away. And next time I see him, I'll ask him what would he suggest about that. By the way, Steve, when he was the chairman of, when he was on the board of Fannie Mae, that was the financial institution. That wasn't the candy company.
Yeah, most people knew that right away, John.
Because I'm thinking, boy, if I could be on the board of Fannie Mae.
What a gig.
Or Hershey's, holy cow, would that be a great job. So I'm reading, I want to talk about the seminar that Yellowbrick is doing in just a minute, but I just want to mention real quick, I'm almost done with Fear, the Bob Woodward book about the Trump presidency, and the word lodestar pops up in the book again. We haven't heard about the word lodestar for some time, but we all know that that was first introduced to the American vocabulary recently when an anonymous op-ed was published in the New York Times describing the disarray in the Trump White House. And how they are hiding documents from him and trying to keep him from his own worst instincts. So we've had that conversation, but said, we still don't know who wrote that. The word lodestar, an unusual word, appears in the essay. So now people are trying to figure out who has previously used the word lodestar. And famously, Mike Pence has used it. I don't know why, but it's come up in his writings or speeches. But he said it's absolutely not him, and it's nobody on his staff. He's so certain it's nobody on his staff, he hasn't even asked them. Some people said maybe it's Jared Kushner, but maybe it's Bob Woodward who uses the word in this book, or maybe it's the person he's actually quoting, which is the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross. Wilbur Ross, in talking about the trade deficit we have with other countries, and he's on board with the president, he said he used the word lodestar. So maybe the plot thickens as we try and figure out who that was. The book is fascinating. I'll tell you what, though, the subtitle of the book, I mean, after all is said and done, this book should be titled Fear or how I told the president about trade and lost, because that is what this book is about. I mean, that is the single unifying and recurring theme. Yes, it's about North Korea. Yes, it's about how he behaved in Charlottesville. Yes, it's about his staff, but the staff is trying to get a central focus for this administration. That's what Rex Tillerson and Mike Mattis and General Matt, all of these guys are trying to do. It's like, okay, what is the plan? How do we do it? And all of these things, trade, defense, intelligence, they all are sort of woven together into one central thesis, one kind of policy. And trade touches all of these things, but Donald Trump wants to change the rules on trade. He wants to bring back American jobs, and he's going to do it with tariffs on other countries. And so they're trying to persuade him. I thought this was very interesting because I don't know much about this, and I figured that the guys he had around him were all sycophants. But in fact, most of the people orbiting around the president are telling him that his views on tariffs and trade are wrong. So when Trump says, okay, we're going to throw a 25% tariff on cars from China, give me that. I want to sign it tomorrow. And they go, Mr. President, there's a process. And then they slow walk things and they hide things, literally, famously. They steal documents that he's supposed to sign off of his desk, and then he kind of forgets about it. There's a half a dozen incidents in this book where there's something he's really hot to do, and they just quietly slip the paper off his desk and he doesn't notice. It happens an alarmingly lot in this book. But at one point, the chairman of the National Economic Advisers, Cohen, says to him, because the president wanted to put a tariff on products from China, and he said, okay, but if you want to get into a trade war with China, because President Trump has famously said the trade wars are easy, he said, fine. You go ahead and, he didn't say fine, but I mean, this is the way it'll go, Mr. President. You put a tariff on, say, 25% on steel or automobiles or computer parts or TV sets coming from China. You want to do that? Go ahead. And you know what they could do tomorrow? They could stop sending us antibiotics. 96% of the antibiotics we get in this country come from China. They could put a tariff on antibiotics. They could tax antibiotics coming out. They could say they're now more expensive, or they could stop selling them to us, period. He said, do you want to tell a mother whose child dies of strep throat that because the United States produces zero penicillin, the trade matters more? You've got to maintain positive relationships with these people. And if you want to play hardball, fine, but you'd better know what the consequences are. All of our antibiotics come from China. Who knew? And then Trump says to him, well, then we'll buy them from Germany. And he says, sure, that's what you'll do. China will sell them to Germany. Germany will mark them up and then sell them to us more expensively. Now you don't have a trade deficit with China, but now you do have a trade deficit with Germany. You're rearranging the chairs on the Titanic. That's the way the book goes over and over again. It's called Fear, Robert Woodward. I've been reading it and posting reviews of it as we go along at WGNradio.com. Actually, we're not posting them on the station site. I'm putting them on my Facebook page. So volume four of my book review will go up today. I've been talking about this, I said seminar, I don't know exactly what you call it, that we're going to be doing with the folks from Yellow Brick. Yellow Brick is that place in Evanston which helps young people launch their lives. If you know someone who's struggling some way, Yellow Brick really might be a place you should check out. And they're going to do this open house where they're going to talk to you about how you talk to your teenagers. The medical director there is a guy named Dr. David Barron, and we asked him to jump on with us a little bit and preview it. Hey, doctor, it's John Williams. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm very well, John. Nice to be with you.
Talk about talking to your teens. I don't even know how to talk. What do we call this thing? Is it an open house, a seminar? What do you call it?
I think you're being modest, John. We would call it a conversation. We're inviting parents in to talk with some of our staff and really also to facilitate some dialogue between parents, because we know that among parents there's a lot of wisdom to be had, and not everyone always has the same wisdom. So we hope to be able to help some, but it's really meant to be a conversation.
Is this for parents whose kids are having real problems, or is it just for any parent?
It's for any parent. I would imagine parents whose kids are having troubles may be a little more drawn to it, but we really welcome anyone. I would say, you know, to reference your what you were talking about earlier, the plot is always thick with adolescents.
Yeah, no
and
kidding.
Sometimes it gets thicker than other times.
Well, so give me a for instance. Like, what's a scenario that you would imagine parents would be dialoguing about or you guys would be offering some suggestions?
Yeah, I think any teen who is kind of manifesting signs of potential trouble, you know, at any level, sometimes it's more minor, sometimes it's more situational, sometimes it's more a kind of evolving serious problem. You know, involvement with drugs, unaccounted for time, you know, concerns about who they're hanging out with, missing school, grades dropping, becoming more isolated. Those tend to be the kinds of warning signs that, you know, something's happening, and it doesn't always tell you what right away. But.
Right. Well, so here's what you do. You say, okay, honey, you'll say this to your husband or your wife. This is the parents talking. They say, we need to bring him in and talk to him about this and tell him that we need to know where he is, or that we smelled marijuana on his clothes and we know something's up here. Or should you soft pedal those things? Because if you come on too strong, you're just going to alienate him. So I wonder how to play that scene.
Well, there's always a balance between too strong and nothing. I think direct communication is always favored, and we're always promoting it over no communication or over clobbering a kid the moment you have any worries. But, you know, and of course every young person is different, and people have different sensitivities, and parents, you know, tend to know their kids best. You know, certainly better than we do when we first meet them, and we learn a lot from that. But, you know, as you know, we were talking earlier, kind of getting ready for this, there's no one right solution that's going to work for every adolescent.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why, you know, when we're treating people, we're trying to take a very individualized approach, even though we know what the developmental themes tend to be.
Dr. David Behrens, the medical director at Yellow Brick in Evanston, next Tuesday night, next Tuesday, the 25th, they're doing this open house. But that's interesting to me because the scenario that you and I were talking about off the air, that you're referencing on the air now, is when I was asking you about social media. I said, should a parent follow their kid on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram? Should they say, okay, you can have a phone or you're going to get a laptop and you're going to be on social media, but we get to see everything that you post? Should a parent say that? And you said, well, it depends, which to me is not yes. I mean, I'm surprised you didn't say yes, a parent should be following their kids on social media.
I think that I don't think there's an absolute answer. I know that sometimes frustrates families when we say things like that. I think for and there are also degrees of following too. You know, there's checking your kid's Facebook page 20, 30 times a day, and there's you know, randomly checking in now and then, you know, so that you know, a particular adolescent knows that that could happen, and those are very different approaches. And you know, for some kids, it may be you know, a moratorium depending on what's been going on when there's bullying and things like that. And maybe, you know, we got to shut down the account for a while and take a break. But, you know, I can't say any of those is exactly the right answer for any particular young person.
Boy, I don't. You're the expert, right? And individuals are different than other individuals, so I hear you. But I here's my advice. Hell yes, you're paying for the thing. Follow them. You don't have to talk to them about everything. You don't have to text back or, you know, comment on their tweet. But I would absolutely be eavesdropping on their communication.
I think that's a value that many parents have, and I certainly don't oppose it. I just think that, you know, I think it's important to recognize that, kind of to back it up to the basic, what we would call the substrate, the working matter of this, which is the human brain and human persons. People are incredibly complex. They're a lot more complicated than we understand, even though we get better every day at understanding it. And to say there's only one way to approach everybody, you know, it's probably is going to miss the boat on some people.
Well, I suppose the mistake I'm making here is that if you're trying to grow the kid, teach them that they can have some responsibility and that they can be independent, which is really what they want.
Exactly.
My helicoptering over their social media maybe is not going to foster that, is it?
it's a really tough developmental stage because the challenge of adolescence, and even more so as people get into emerging adulthood, you know, after 18 on to early, late 20s, early 30s, is to become separate and independent while still having some connection to your family and your parents and the important people in your life. In fact, it's really hard to become independent if you don't have a stable launch platform. It's kind of like trying to push off a diving board, and no matter how hard you push, the board just keeps going lower and lower and doesn't bounce. And you can't really make a good dive that way. So, you know, the balance is to be found in what do we do to promote independence, you know, and like for early teens to allow some privileges and things that get done independently, and what do we do to, you know, both, you know, create conditions in which a person can take those risks more safely. They know they have parents to come back to if something goes wrong. They know they have parents that aren't going to condemn them if it goes wrong, but that they get some opportunities to take those risks, because otherwise you can't become independent. You know, we don't just grow kids. We try to strike some balance between growing them and them growing themselves.
Yellowbrickprogram.com. Go there now, and you can find out more about this free event next Tuesday night in Evanston. I'll say hi, then get out of the way, because clearly I don't know what I'm talking about. And then we'll let these people hear you and talk to you as well. Dr. David Behrens, the medical director at Yellowbrick. Okay, doctor, good luck. I will see you guys a week from tomorrow. Thanks for your time this afternoon, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you very much, John. We look forward to seeing you.
Yeah, no kidding. Yellowbrickprogram.com. By the way, I was glad to see Paulke get the couple of home runs, although I have to chuckle because they say that's a new record for the White Sox for home runs by a rookie left-hander. I mean, it's great. 24 home runs is 24 more than some people hit. So it's I like Paulke, but I just love how baseball will find something special about a lot of things. Those statistics, you can drill down. And so he is the rookie leader by the White Sox for left-handers hitting home runs, which is a good thing. Baez and Goldschmidt, MVP candidates, collide on WGN-TV tonight at 8:30 as the Cubs take on the Diamondbacks. Oh, and thanks again to the folks from Yellowbrick for coming on here. Remember that event, you can find out more at yellowbrickprogram.com, yellowbrickprogram.com. It's Tuesday, September 25th at 7 p.m. And where they work with young people, say 14 to 24, even a little older, they call those people emerging adults. This conversation about how to talk to your kids is really geared for people whose kids are in high school. So if you've got a teenager and maybe you're having problems, maybe you're not, and if you are wondering about some of their choices and how do we tackle this as a family, then you want to go to this event. It's especially geared for kids in high school's parents. It's going to be Tuesday, September 25th. Go to yellowbrickprogram.com, yellowbrickprogram.com. It's 2:27. We'll go into the WGN Radio newsroom. Steve Bertrand will have that for us after the news click. Hey, Olive, should we do the news click now or should we do it later? All right, Olive says now. The news click for today, our daily web poll question is:
should the Senate confirmation hearing of Brett Kavanaugh be delayed until assault allegations are investigated? A. Yes, we need as much information about him as possible. B. No, what he might have done in high school isn't relevant. C. No, I don't believe the accusations.
Lots of texts about that. I'll read a couple of those after the news. Go to WGNradio.com or on my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John to comment on that. There is a store in Chicago we'll talk about before we get done here at 3. There's only four in the United States, and the only one outside of Seattle is in Chicago now. It opens today. We're going to do a field trip on this show over there. Before we talk about that, Stacy St. Clair from the Chicago Tribune, a terrific reporter over there and a longtime friend of this show, joins us from the press room at the Jason Van Dyke trial. Hi, Stacy. It's John. You're on the air.
Hey, John. How are you?
Good. So we're talking about Laquan McDonald's killing, mm-hmm. and he's charged with murder, 16 counts of, what is it, aggravated battery?
Counts of aggravated battery. He was originally charged with 6 counts of first-degree murder, but prosecutors dropped 4 of those counts today, so now he's only facing 2 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of official misconduct.
They are on recess right now. I know you've stepped into the press room for us. What's happening?
Jurors right now are watching, again, a video of the shooting, and they're being walked through it by an FBI forensics expert who's sort of walking them by sort of second by second of two different videos they have, one from a squad car and then one from the Dunkin' Donuts nearby the shooting scene.
I'm familiar with the one from the squad car. That's the one I suppose most of us have seen where he's walking right down the street and he gets shot. Does the other video show add some other context?
Not really, no. But I think one of the reasons the prosecution is showing it is because, you know, the defense today in their opening statement said this video, one of the reasons that Van Dyke pulled his trigger was because Laquan McDonald was making a run for and planning to attack the Dunkin' Donuts, and then so it was a matter of protecting the public when he fired his gun. And so far the video that's been shown that I've seen did not show that.
Well, the prosecution goes first, then the defense. Do we know mm-hmm. what the defense is essentially going to be?
Yeah, the defense is going to be that Jason Van Dyke had was afraid for his own safety and for safety, the safety of the public. So he was trying to protect both himself and the public when he fired his gun.
You got any more than that?
No, that's the whole case. If Jason Van Dyke convinces this jury that he had a reasonable fear for his life or the life of any other member of the public, then when he fired that first shot, he was legally justified in doing so. And if the jury finds that first shot was legal under state law, the 16th shot is legal, and that's the end of the case. That's what they need to prove.
Stacey, a little light just went on in my head. That is, mm-hmm. sure, you can say that this young man might have been a danger to the public or the police. He could have mm-hmm. turned on them and come after them. But at that instant, I mean, I wonder if this is how this thing is going to be sliced, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he would have been a threat to somebody, but clearly he was walking away from the officers at the time. I wonder how they're going to resolve that.
Yeah, that is not what the defense told the jury today. The defense told the jury that, hey, you may have already seen this video, and this video you're going to see will show you one vantage point. And that vantage point is not what Jason Van Dyke was seeing. That is the vantage point of another officer squad car. So what they said that they've done is they have recreated their own video. It's an animated video that will show the jury what it looks like from Jason Van Dyke's vantage point.
That's
and they said, once you see our creation, you're gonna see that our guy was justified in shooting. But I will say this whole protect the Dunkin' Donuts defense, that is new. I've been covering this case for a long time now, and no one has ever said the Dunkin' Donuts was about to be attacked.
We have the video from the Dunkin' Donuts. Was he heading in the direction of that place?
He's walking. It's on Pulaski, right? And he's walking down Pulaski. And there's a disagreement whether you think he's walking, you know, if you're the prosecutors, you say he's walking straight down Pulaski. If you're, you know, the defense, you say there's a moment where he sort of turns. And that's what the jury is going to have to decide.
Will the judge allow this animation since it's not the actual video? I guess so, huh?
He will, but he did ban it from being shown during opening statements, and he did allow the prosecution to show the dash cord video, as we all know it. He did allow that to be shown during opening statements.
You haven't seen this animated video then?
I haven't seen it yet, no.
Stacey, I'm intrigued by that, though. That's a perspective, now that you mention it, that we haven't seen.
I mean, that is one thing that's undisputed. The vantage point of this video, you are not seeing what Jason Van Dyke saw. You are seeing what a fellow officer saw, or that his squad car saw, I guess, on the scene that night.
Can you just briefly comment, and then I'll let you go, on mm-hmm. the personality or the style of the attorneys for both sides? How are they doing it?
Sure. They are exact opposites. McMahon, the special prosecutor, he's very workmanlike, very methodical, sort of walked the jury during his opening statements through a minute by minute of what happens once that 911 call comes in, reporting an attempted burglary and then all the way up to the shooting. But he did have a really good moment for him where he sort of counted out the shots for the jury. And when he gets to 8 shots, he says, "And we're only halfway there." And he keeps saying, you know, 8, 9, 10. So that was a pretty dramatic moment for him. He also brought race into it for the first time publicly from a prosecutor. And he said, Laquan McDonald was shot because he was a black boy who had the audacity not to stop walking when the police told him to. And that was sort of jarring for everyone in the press because the prosecution really hasn't talked about race in the lead-up. To the contrary, you know, Dan Herbert is a longtime FOP attorney. He's very dramatic in court, very passionate, arms flailing, voice rising, and, you know, he gave what I would call a classic Dan Herbert opening. Very emotional, very passionate, very staunchly behind his guy.
I guess it's too early to wonder if you can get any read on the jurors, eh?
Yeah, the first day of the trial is always the same with the jury. Everyone has sort of like that stone expression, you know, in their face, and they take everything, you know, very seriously. If we check back in like, you know, a week and a half with me, and I'll tell you like when they start rolling their eyes and when they start giving each other side looks and everything. But the first couple days, everybody sort of, you know, keeps that neutral expression.
Will other officers be called to testify?
Yeah, there already was one today, Joseph McGillett. And he was the officer who first responded to the call of the attempted burglary, and he followed behind on foot Laquan McDonald for several minutes, and he said that he knew Laquan had a knife and that he pulled his gun. You know, he drew his gun, but he never fired it because he didn't think that his life was in danger, and he didn't think that his partner's life was in danger, and he knew that they had called for a taser unit and that a taser unit was on its way. He said, we were just going to be patient.
Well, that's not good for Mr. Van Dyke, is it?
Probably not, no.
Probably.
I don't want to get in the jury's mind, but yeah, no.
But I mean, yeah, because that's... I think critical. Some people are critical of these other officers who mm-hmm. also filed reports that didn't seem to match the video. We're not hearing from those guys, though, are we?
No, the officer who... we might. There's been talk about that, but the officer who testified this morning has never faced disciplinary, has not been accused of wrongdoing in this case, and he's still a police officer. He was wearing his uniform on the stand.
Stacey St. Clair writes for the Chicago Tribune. You can read her story online. I presume, are you filing reports as the afternoon goes?
We are live blogging and tweeting, and we are on every platform you could imagine right now.
Nice to talk to you, Stacey. I'll let you
always
go back to your work. We'll read you in the paper tomorrow, too.
All right. Take care, guys.
That's Stacey St. Clair, reporter for the Chicago Tribune. I think Steve said that you can hear it at WGNradio.com. I'm going to confirm that, but if that's the case, I want to reiterate that. By the way, Violetta, that means that we are going to be busy on Friday. Today's Monday, so Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. Let's, Elif, you and me and V, go to this new Amazon Go store that I'm hearing about.
Yeah, I'm ready for that.
I hear everything's free. There's no cashier.
Yeah, you just get to walk in and walk out.
Woohoo!
Did you say Thursday, though?
Why are you asking?
Well, could we do it Wednesday instead?
Tuesday or Wednesday. Yeah, we could do it tomorrow or Wednesday.
Yeah.
Maybe. Thursday, we could record the Mincing Rascals podcast, so that would be bad.
Inquiring minds must know.
Well, so here's, I'll tell you what, I guess this is the 21st century and I need to get on board, but here's what it is. They have four of these in the country. They're in Seattle, and then this is the only one outside of the Seattle area, I guess. It's an Amazon Go store. It's prepackaged food. It's grab and go. So if you want to grab something and take it home, throw it in the microwave, it's ready to go meals. They're putting it in the Loop downtown, not too far from Union Station. And the novelty of it is that there's no cashiers and you don't pay. If you're an Amazon subscriber, it'll know on your phone, you'll have the app. They'll go, boop, Violetta's in the store. And then it says here in the Sun Crimes, it says when customers enter, they scan a barcode from the Amazon Go app on their smartphone. From there, customers are tracked by computer vision on the ceiling, and it'll record whatever they take off the shelves. When they're done, they walk out, no lines, no payment necessary. And then you'll get a message saying you've been charged $17 for the tuna.
My heart's racing just thinking about it. I'm going to feel like I'm shoplifting.
You'll walk in. It'll go boop, and it'll follow you with a camera, and then when you take that thing, or if somebody else in your, like your kids, put stuff in your bag, whatever, it'll go, oh, they took that, oh, they took that, And then when you walk out, boop, it knows you're gone, and then it sends you your bill.
According to the Amazon Go vice president, a lot of people have been checking in with the person at the exit going, hey, this is how much stuff I have. Are you sure I can leave with this?
You're sure it's okay, we go, right? And they go, yeah, dude, the computers have been watching you. And so that's my, okay, so here's just me being a curmudgeon. There's more jobs that people don't have. It's just you go in and they stock it. It's so flipping impersonal. You'll walk in, there'll be food, you'll walk out, you will not even talk to or pay a person.
But what if, like, you know, I want you to pick up my lunch and I get charged for it?
Yeah, I guess we'd have to use some sort of PayPal or something to...
Then you Venmo each other.
Yeah, Venmo
or whatever,
each other back and forth, yeah.
Here's my curmudgeonly statement at the age of, at the old age that I am.
The way, which is what, by the way? Mid-20s?
Yes.
Something like that.
My problem with this is that it's going to eat up more storage on my phone. That's the second thing that's plaguing our generations.
Yeah.
Generation.
Yeah, we're all walking around going, okay, take a picture of this, we'll post it. And they go, no, my storage is full.
Yeah.
I mean, your storage is full.
Mm-hmm.
Soon it's going to just not be an issue, though. Like, unlimited storage is going
to
be inevitable.
We'll find a way to
You're
do
right.
That.
I think so, because they've created... unlimited texting. They've created unlimited data. There's got to be unlimited storage.
No, well, there's definitely unlimited storage. As of right now, though, you have to pay for it.
Right. So. That's the thing.
Amazon Go has ready-to-cook dinners that promise dinner for two from box to table in about 30 minutes, featuring options like orzo risotto and five-spice chicken for about $17. The only Amazon Go currently outside of Seattle. And the fourth overall is in the Loop in Chicago. It opens today. So we'll have to put the app on our phone, eat up some storage. Then we're going to go in. I guess we'll have to enter our credit card number.
But I don't have Amazon.
You're going to have to get Amazon Go.
What? I'm going to find out how many gigabytes it is right now in real time.
Really? So this is a I had not anticipated that. Okay. So, yeah, make sure that it's something that you want to use. And then you're going to walk in, just pull the thing out, and you're going to take your little bag that I guess you brought with you, your cloth bag, and then you're just going to put the food in there and then walk out. Just walk in, walk out. It will eliminate, I mean, really, like we go to Whole Foods and the Jewels. That's where Brenda and I go most of the time, and sometimes to Mariano's. Those other two are closer to us. But, you know, you can get the food quick enough, although I will sometimes spend godless amount of times looking for a particular kind of canned beans or the right thing. You know, Brenda will say, now get this, and then we need the black-eyed peas, and they have 82,000 cans there, and I feel my chest caving in on me as I'm looking for these products.
I've actually asked the person next to me, I'm like, we've been here forever. Like, what are you looking for? I need some cayenne pepper.
Let's
one I've had trouble finding, cayenne pepper.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's all in these healthy drinks you're supposed to do with water.
Why don't they have a thing where you just go, I don't know, a kiosk at the store or an app at Whole Foods or whatever, and I go, where is cayenne pepper? Where are the Black Eyed Peas?
Well, I'm in the Black Eyed Peas. That's a band.
It's also a food I can't find. I have a better chance of finding the Black Eyed Peas than I do the Black Eyed Peas. So, I mean, but why don't they have a thing that you could just dial in, boop, 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 and it'll go, aisle 7.
Well, I know where it is, but I can't find it on the shelf.
Yeah.
Well, there's too many options.
Well, but I mean, I don't know, geo-track me. I don't know. Have a thing go beep, beep.
You are
16 inches from Black Eyed Peas.
Speaking of storage on iPhones and other phones, it's 22.2 megabytes.
Okay, so that means something to somebody. Does that mean something to you?
No, I don't know what that means.
It means a lot.
So you're going to eat up some storage, and then we're going to walk. So we're going to do this field
trip. You're going to have to delete some pictures and memories, okay? We need to do this.
We will take some video of our adventure there tomorrow or the next day, and you'll be able to find it at WGNradio.com. We'll go into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom in just a minute. We'll also say hi to Ro and Anna, find out what's coming up on their show, and then Judy will update us on the news. Ro Khan, Anna DeVlantis, what are you guys doing today?
Oh, nothing, John. Nothing to see here. We're going to talk about...
nothing in the news.
We're going to talk about nail salons, Vitus nail salons in Chicago.
That's big.
Yeah. You talked to Bill Daley. Interesting interview, wouldn't you say? John, did you have
I think he's an interesting guy. I'm mad at him that I didn't ask him if he agrees with his brother's selling of the parking meters. But
well,
I guess that's...
you know what? We get a second bite of the apple today. Coming
ask
up in about 40 minutes, we're going to talk to him.
What are you going to press him?
Well, I think that, but you know, is your brother's legacy is controversial, so do you stand by it? What parts do you stand by? Obviously, why now? Why are you getting it now? Why weren't you in before? That sort of stuff. So we'll see.
How much money is he worth, do you think?
A lot. I don't know.
He certainly has enough to run for mayor, that's for sure. And he'll raise a lot of dough,
He could
too.
Self-finance, right? Don't you suppose?
I would imagine he's done very well. Yeah. You know, he was a major executive of a couple Fortune 500 companies in between all of this. You know, once you are a commerce secretary, it works out. Could work out. The current commerce secretary would be very lucky not to fall asleep after, according to the president, by the way, before you go, that's unfair. That's what the president said.
Yeah.
About.
But you do wonder how much of his brother's legacy will automatically be transferred to him and that he'll have to answer it.
Right.
Or is that a bad thing?
Or I mean, it might be good.
And maybe it'll be good in some people's eyes.
In some respects, it might be good. So all that's coming your way. And Laquan McDonald, the murder trial of Jason Van Dyke and the death of Laquan McDonald continues, and we will continue to dip in and out of that and then have expert analysis as the trial ends this afternoon.
As the testimony, or the trial doesn't end this afternoon.
I'm sorry, the testimony ends. Yeah. Thank you very much for the clarification. And OB is going to be here to break some furniture.
Watch out.
Ed Obradovich, the great Chicago Bear,
well,
former
we
Chicago Bear.
We haven't lost yet, Ro. I mean, maybe we're going to beat Seattle.
I'm having palpitations all day about this. I got thoughts. It was such a crazy weekend in the NFL, and now I'm just kind of feeling they really need to win this game. Otherwise, they're going to go 0-4.
Can I tell you something that I did over the weekend? I'm watching Green Bay and Vikings in the fourth quarter, and I see this interception. So I turn the TV off and go, game's over. I hate it the way it ended. And then my son texts me, go, can you believe this overtime? And I go, they can't be in overtime. They just... All they had to do was run out the clock.
It ended so many times.
That
right?
interception got called back because there was roughing the passer. I missed all of that because
and
I got
the way
mad
it ended in a tie, right?
Was
that
a tie?
That's
which is
not
good.
Right.
That's very good. No, that
I don't
you,
like
oh,
that.
That is so good though
I
for the
hate
Bears.
Ties in the NFL.
I know,
but please, people, this is important. A tie is not a win for two of our division rivals.
That's true.
Think about that
wow,
for a second.
That's really. They both play each other and. It's good for us on both counts,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is. That is, I mean, it's almost the best possible outcome.
All right, I'm out of the way.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thanks, Tom.
Bye.
All right.